own insect bodyguards and reduce the need for chemical pesticides.
Wow, pretty cool, Don. Perhaps I won't give up on gardening just yet.
This moment of science comes from Indiana University.
Today's program was prepared by Sue Ann Zollinger, with help from Roger Hangarter in biology. For A Moment of Science, I'm Yael Cassander.
And I'm Don Glass.
Let's take a look at what's happening now in the world of sports. First up, Beijing. Usain Bolt has become the ninth male sprinter to sweep the 100 and 200 gold medals at a single Olympics and the first to do it in world record time. The Jamaican completed the feat with a run of 19.30 seconds in the 200, shaving 0.02 of 1 second off the old mark set by Michael Johnson at the 1996 Atlanta Games. Bolt's performance comes 4 days after he bettered his own world record in the 100. Sprinter Tirandi Martina of Netherlands Antilles originally was credited with a second-place finish in the 200 meters, more than a half a second behind Bolt's record-setting run. But Martina was disqualified after the U.S. team protested that he had run out of his lane. The ruling allowed Sean Crawford to take the silver medal and gave American teammate Walter Dix the bronze. Kobe Bryant scored 25 points and LeBron James added 16 as the U.S. men's basketball team clobbered Australia 116-85 in the Olympic quarterfinals. The U.S. men's volleyball team remains perfect in Beijing, beating Serbia in 5 sets to move into the semifinals against Russia. And the American baseball and softball teams needed extra innings to knock off Japan today. Brian Barden provided the go-ahead single in a 4-run 11th as the baseball squad beat the Japanese 4-2, putting the Americans in the medal round. Crystal Bustos hit a 3-run homer while the softball team was scoring 4 times in the 9th to win 4-1 and advance to the gold medal game. In Chicago, the Chicago White Sox are trying to complete their first sweep of the Seattle Mariners at home since 2004. Seattle has the worst record in the American League and has lost 5 straight. The Sox, meanwhile, have already matched their win total from last year when they finished 72-90. Currently, Chicago is 72-53. In the bottom of the 5th, Chicago leads Seattle 10-3. The Cards host Pittsburgh tonight, and the Chicago Cubs will attempt to build their largest division lead in 24 years when they continue a 3-game series against Cincinnati tonight in Chicago. And Colts quarterback Peyton Manning made it to his first practice of the season yesterday after having surgery to remove an infected bursa sac from his knee in July. Manning says he wants to play in Indianapolis' first regular season game September 7th against the Chicago Bears. That's sports.
WILL programming is made possible by Tires Plus Total Car Care, located at Prospect and Market View in Champaign. Tires Plus provides complete car repair and maintenance. More information is available at 366-3201.
It's 2:43. Defenders of the Pontiac Correctional Center have been gearing up for a last major effort to save the facility in Livingston County. Charlie Schlenker has more on the arguments that will be made at a government hearing in Pontiac this evening.
The Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability will listen to hours of testimony about the effects of closing Pontiac Prison and moving inmates mainly to Thompson, north of the Quad Cities near the Iowa border. Pontiac Mayor Scott McCoy says retail sales will plummet, eroding government revenue. Water and sewer usage will drain away, costing $300,000 a year in sewer billing alone. Property values will fall with the exit of 600 direct correctional center jobs, which will give schools less money.
It's just a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 punch as everything affects something else, and in turn that affects something else. So it's pretty devastating for the city of Pontiac.
McCoy says the prison is also the largest customer for Illinois American Water and for Allied American Waste Disposal, putting those services in jeopardy too.
We get to that trickle through the community effect of just kind of wiping you out, and who knows how far it's going to go.
Enter healthcare. OSF St. James Hospital in Pontiac has already seen what OSF Administrator Ken Natsky calls an alarming increase in uncompensated healthcare in that area. Natsky says losing the prison and the revenue stream from the state contract for health care of inmates may put St. James over the edge.
Viability is a question of where resources are put. I could say that it might not be economically viable, but I won't say that it's not viable as an institution because at this time, we have a commitment to that community.
Other Pontiac area officials worry that too many of the spouses of workers at the correctional center work at St. James. When those jobs leave, the spouses leave too, nurses, doctors, volunteers, and technicians at the hospital, leaving a gaping hole in the staffing needed to preserve a health care delivery network. That hurts everyone in the surrounding counties. The McLean County Chamber of Commerce says direct business impacts of a closure would flow as far as Bloomington Normal. Bloomington Mayor Steve Stockton takes a more strategic vision. He says central placement of correctional centers matters for major population centers in the state. Stockton says Western Illinois is simply inconvenient.
Pontiac is much closer to our population centers. If we are to rehabilitate family and community support, is vital. Pontiac is ideally located not only for the Bloomington area, but also to the much larger Chicago area.
And Pontiac supporters say the studies that justify Governor Rod Blagojevich's proposals are fishy. Joe Pluger, the staff representative for Ask Me Council 31, representing prison guards, says there are numerous flaws and contradictions in the report. He says Pontiac houses the worst of the worst, which means it has the lowest number of double-bedded inmates in the state.
Closing Pontiac will result in more double-selling throughout the whole state and sending maximum security inmates to lower-secured prisons without increasing the staff, which we believe will endanger inmates and staff.
Pluger says sub-200 maximum security inmates would go to the medium-security prison in Pinckneyville, and he says the prison at Thompson also doesn't have enough segregated cells in the yard for the most violent or mentally ill inmates who are a danger to themselves and others. Pluger also says the $100 million savings the Department of Corrections claims from the change is wildly overstated.
We don't believe that they currently have budgeted enough money to open 800 beds at Thompson under their plan. Their budget increased Thompson, I think, by a two-thirds increase, who is currently running a minimum security facility of around 200 inmates.
But Pluger says an internal DOC engineering study really shows only $5 to $7 million in savings, not enough to warrant uprooting entire communities. Pluger says the Department of Corrections study on the economic impact of the proposed change to both Pontiac and Thompson areas isn't intellectually honest. He says they did not estimate a total employment loss at Pontiac, even though all the jobs are moving out, but were far too rosy in gauging the benefits to Thompson.
The number that they say that workers were going to go there, they either included the current workforce or expectation of growth in the number. So the numbers were not apples to apples.
Pluger cites another instance in which the harmful economic impact of Pontiac was studied in four surrounding counties, but the benefits to Thompson were apportioned to six counties around that tiny town, including one that was not contiguous. Municipal and regional officials and residents have been gearing up for the commission hearing for months, but in the end, it could be a meaningless exercise. Pontiac Mayor Scott McCoy says the governor can rip out the prison from Pontiac no matter the evidence.
It's a waste of taxpayer money. It's a waste of the commission's time. It's a waste of our time if it's going to really mean nothing to somebody who can just push the button and not even look at the report.
Some lawmakers share that feeling and have introduced legislation to put some binding authority into the commission opinion. The looming departure of Senate President Emil Jones, a staunch ally of Governor Blagojevich, might make passage of such a bill more likely, but Pontiac-friendly lawmakers agree that even that shifting political balance won't happen in time to affect what happens at Pontiac. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Tonight's hearing over the Pontiac Correctional Center's future is at 5 o'clock at Pontiac Township High School. Cuba's President Raul Castro has gained some attention with an announcement that he will allow private farmers access of up to 100 acres of idle government land. It's a small shift toward private enterprise. Cuba is also looking for more foreign investors to help tap its petroleum and mineral reserves. NPR's Jason Bobian reports.
At a small roadside farm stand on the outskirts of Havana, crisp bunches of lettuce, green beans, and okra are piled on a wooden countertop. What's unique here is that unlike at larger, state-run farms, these growers get to keep the proceeds from their produce. Juan Carlos Avila Fajardo stands behind the counter and describes the vegetables that are currently in season. This cooperative stems from reforms in the 1990s, when the economy was left reeling after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Last month, Raul Castro's administration announced new reforms that could create even more small farms like this one. The new law will grant private farmers concessions to work large tracts of state-owned land for up to 10 years. Avila at the farm stall says he supports Raul's efforts at reform. He says Raul is allowing farmers to legalize their plots of land, and this boosts the supply of food to the people. And nationwide, this is something Cuba is desperate to achieve.
The situation of agriculture is terrible in Cuba.
Oscar Espinosa Chepe is a Cuban economist and dissident. Espinosa used to be a high-ranking government official, but his support for opening up Cuba's tightly controlled socialist economy has put him at odds with the state. He was even jailed in 2003 for criticizing government policy. Espinosa says Cuban agriculture is in shambles.
Cuba is importing about 85% of the food that we need. It's incredible because in the past, Cuba was an important exporter of food.
Cuba is offering untended state-owned farmland to private individuals, in part because it has so much of it. According to the government, more than half of the farmland in what used to be the world's largest sugar exporter is now fallow. Espinosa praises Raul Castro's agricultural reforms as steps in the right direction, but he doesn't think they go far enough. Despite being one of the last communist regimes in the world, Cuba has allowed private enterprise in some sectors. Many of the island's tourist resorts were built with investment from European hotel chains. Foreigners have also invested in mines and factories. And starting in the 1990s, the government allowed some people to open small private restaurants called paladars in their homes. In the narrow kitchen at La Guarida in Havana, the staff is preparing for the afternoon rush. Pans of vegetables simmer on the gas range. The chef rapidly chops a white onion. Enrique Nunez started this paladar 12 years ago in an ornate but crumbling old building. His restaurant has been hugely successful, but he says, regrettably, most of his customers are diplomats, entrepreneurs, and foreign visitors. The main reason we don't have Cuban customers, he says, is because they can't afford the prices. The average Cuban worker earns just $20 a month. This would barely cover an order of snapper carpaccio and the pork with mango salsa. The government only allows paladars to seat 12 customers at a time. Some other establishments overtly flaunt this rule. One across town has 12 tables. Nunez says he'd like to expand and possibly open up some other businesses.
Me considero estar preparado y capacitado para hacerlo.
I have the ability to do it, he says, and I think opportunities should come. We have to be patient. I have bet on Cuba and on the future of Cuba, and that's why I'm here.
Simplemente estamos esperando.
And he adds, we are simply waiting. Raul Castro has suggested that he might allow more private enterprise on the island. The new president even said he may lift salary caps. Laying out an ideological break with his older brother Fidel, Raul recently stated that socialism means equality of rights and not necessarily equality of income. In that same speech, however, Raul cautioned that the nation is facing hard times and needs to be realistic, while sending signals that he wants to loosen the state's grip somewhat on the economy. He also warned that rising global food prices could lead to even more belt tightening in Cuba. Jason Beaubien, NPR News.
There's a sound after 5 years of war that has finally returned to Baghdad. That train whistle is a powerful signal that things may be getting back to normal in the Iraqi capital. For NPR Baghdad reporter Isra Al-Rubai, it has also brought back fond memories.
The whistle of the overnight train from the southern city of Basra pierces the morning silence of Baghdad. While there's much that divides Iraqis these days, one thing that unites them is a love of train travel, a joy that they were denied for years because of violence and economic hardship. But thanks to a relative improvement in the security situation and low ticket prices, Baghdad's Blue Domed Railway Station is bustling again. Muhammad Ali Hashim is in charge of the railway station. Hashim says there are plans to upgrade Iraq's rail network for both passengers and cargo, but that will take both time and money. We need $4 to $5 million in emergency aid, he says, just to keep functioning at minimum capacity. But lack of services and the volatile security situation could not deter Natiq Mahmoud, 57, a local poet, from taking the train in pursuit of a bigger space to meditate and write his verse, just as he used to do in his youth.
When you take the train, you recall your childhood, your youth. You pick up a pen and put down your thoughts on paper.
The Baghdad station was built by a British firm in 1953. The blue dome and the marble floor give an air of the colonial era. But there are also signs of another era. In the 1980s, hundreds of Iraqi soldiers etched their names into the cement benches before making their one-way trip to the battlefront with Iran. 51-year-old Jamal Abdullah has been a train engineer for 34 years. Walking along the dusty platform, he points to an abandoned train, which he says he drove all the way from war-ravaged Basra to Baghdad to transport dead and wounded soldiers. He says the moans of the living and the smell of blood linger in his memory. Paradox is only a few meters away, the luxuriously furnished train that Saddam Hussein kept for himself and his entourage. After the U.S. invasion and the fall of Saddam, looters ripped off the curtains, got away with the gold-plated toilets, and destroyed the train's lavish swimming pool, but fortunately left the engine intact. Saddam's train has now been refurbished and is expected to return to service once the rail line to Turkey is restored. At 10 o'clock a.m., the train from Basra enters the station and disgorges its weary passengers after the 12-hour journey. At 10:30, there's one more whistle from the Basra train before it leaves the platform on the return journey. As it picks up speed, the poet reaches for his pen.
مرينا بيكم محمد واحنا بقطار الليل.
And in the cabin of the locomotive, the driver starts to sing Hamad and the Train, a song that most Iraqis memorize as children.
يا ريل صيح بقهر.
The train fades into the distance, and so does the driver's voice, taking with it the memory of a past that's there no more. Isra Rubai, NPR News, Baghdad.
Earth and Sky.
Wednesday, August 20th, 2008. Last June, the planet Venus swung behind.